Sink or Swim by Clotpole of the Lord, a.k.a. Plantain Leaf. Read by Library Chick 94. Fandom, Stargate Atlantis. Relationship, Rodney McKay, John Shepherd. Rating is mature.
"This is all your fault," hisses Rodney as Shepherd grabs him by the shoulder of his tack vest and yanks him forward into a gap between the rocks.
"Shut up, Rodney," Shepherd replies, voice harsh and almost inaudible in Rodney's ear as he drags him into the cave and shoves him forward, then tumbles down beside him. Rodney nearly curses out loud when Shepherd's fingers brush the bit of skin beside the collar of his shirt, and a wave of emotion that he can't quite break down into individual feelings nearly swamps him.
"Goddamn ancients," he thinks angrily, pulling away and tugging his jacket sleeves until they cover his hands. And it had been such a normal mission, too. Just your everyday trade with the primitive people mission, like 1,000 they've done before without incident in this stupid galaxy. This particular one involved a people that Taylor had heard about secondhand, and who were said to have relics from the ancients and a particularly hardy strain of a vegetable halfway between wheat and chickpeas. He should have known everything would go wrong.
6 hours earlier. When they step through the gate on M46834, a crowd of smiling men in robes move forward and surround them as Taylor begins her traditional little welcome speech. Before she can get out more than a sentence, though, they're herded down the path to a bustling village full of thatched roofs, whitewashed walls, and ruminants and pens, to the largest building in the center of town. Shepherd grips his P90 tightly, fingers white-knuckled despite his easy smile, and Ronan's gun is just barely in its holster. Rodney's pretty sure it's just Taylor's influence that's keeping them from bloodshed. Well, that and the large ancient plus basic electronics devices three of the priests have trained on them as soon as they enter the square. And it says something about the kind of life Rodney's been leading these last couple years that doesn't even really register as a major threat. It's all very civilized, though, compared to some planets, and he supposes he should be grateful for that much anyway. No one's been shot at yet, and the natives are still smiling, and it's not a welcome-honored guest smile or that crazed wraith worshipper smile either. Somewhere in between, more like excited for religious hooey smiling if he's reading them right, which he is, because, hello, genius. But of course it doesn't stay so calm. It never does. There's a special magic test, which of course is a piece of ancient technology that Colonel Magic Jeans makes light up like a Christmas tree, and okay, yes, it glows a little when it's pressed to Rodney's face. And then Taylor and Ronan are shown to the door, and apparently led back to the Stargate, while the two of them are tossed in a cell, weapons confiscated, and, confusingly, given a banquet table of food and drink before the door swings shut with a loud, ominous click. "This is just great," Rodney says, staring at the closed door. "Just what I wanted to be doing on this mission, locked in another cell by superstitious natives." He turns to John. "And that thing definitely did something to me, not just the usual check for gene sort of thing, either." John pokes at the bowl of bread-like puffs on the table. They remind Rodney of the puri from the Indian restaurant down the street from his Colorado Springs apartment, although that wasn't usually served with what looks like grapes the size of mangoes, and his stomach grumbles. "Better spread than the usual cell, though," John observes, picking up a grape thing and sniffing it.
"Don't eat it!"
Rodney grabs for it, a veteran of the consequences of eating bizarre alien fruits, and John yanks his hand back.
"You don't know what it is. They could be trying to... Ha!"
He finally gets a hand around the fruit and starts to yank it away, when suddenly he's filled with an unfamiliar burst of annoyance, anger, and what's maybe a little bit of relief. He gasps, somewhere in the back of his mind registering that John's tense all over, and they both fall a step back. The feeling is gone as quickly as it began.
"What the hell was that?" says John, sprawled on the floor, forgotten fruit squashed beside him in a lurid purple smear.
Rodney takes a deep breath, trying to calm his racing heart. "I have no idea." He shudders. "But let's try and not do it again. How about that?" John sits up carefully.
"Agreed."
He pulls himself up to a standing position and brushes off the back of his pants.
"The fruit, you think?"
Rodney shrugs. "Could be the fruit, the room, the planet, the sun. Could be anything. It could be our cells exploding, or radiation. Do you know how much radiation we're exposed to, Colonel? Or... He sags. "It could be anything. I've got nothing." John shakes his head and paces across the room and back, glaring at the door.
"I don't like it," Rodney rolls his eyes. Yeah, I'm getting that. He eyes the table, trying to remind himself again that eating the delicious-smelling pastries is probably a bad thing. Did you... John lets out a whoosh of a sigh. Did it give you, well, a feeling? I mean, yeah, whatever it was had an emotional component. It wasn't quite what I was feeling, either. John freezes and turns slowly towards Rodney. You, wouldn't happen to be feeling sort of annoyed and terrified and kind of hungry, would you? With just a little bit of nausea thrown in? Rodney looks up and meets John's eyes. Yes, actually. Oh, no. Well, John's answering smile is grim. At least it's not a stranger's weirdly intrusive emotions, right? Honestly, I'm not sure which would be worse. Rodney's voice is tense, and he tries to stuff any emotions down into a box deep under his conscious mind, but really, that just makes him more freaked out. So instead, he does what usually helps him deal with wayward feelings and focuses on the problem at hand. So what, we had some sort of emotion exchange? He doesn't wait for John to answer before he continues, snapping his fingers. I bet it was that device, the one that got us thrown in here. What, it's a... John frowns. A feelings machine? What the hell use would that be, Rodney? And how do we keep it from doing it again? Well, how should I know? And excuse me for hypothesizing. I have exactly the same data you do, and you don't seem to be coming up with anything, Mr. I could have been Mensa. He reaches out and gives John a shove, and when his fingers brush the edge of John's forearm where it peeks out from his rolled-up sleeves, he's hit with another burst of emotion, crashing over him like a wave as John lets out a choked gasp. Okay, seriously, not cool. He shudders. So, it's touch-based, obviously. John rolls down his sleeves, tugging at them, and shoves himself back until he's against the wall, a good 4 feet from Rodney. Obviously. He tugs at the cuffs of his jacket until its sleeves cover his palms. Now how do we stop it? And while we're thinking, how about a way out of here before they come back for whatever they want our genes for? Discomfort flickers across his face. Weapons are breeding. It's always weapons are breeding. Well, we do have exceptional genes, says Rodney, a little absently, since he started running careful fingers around the doorframe. John follows suit, examining the window frame and working his fingers into the gap between the shutters until he can locate the latch. Grimacing, he shoves his index finger a little deeper and pops the latch open with a careful flick. The shutters ease open a few inches, and he peeks through. We're just about 10 feet up, he reports, and Rodney abandons his examination of the door to join him beside the window, carefully keeping a good 18 inches between them. Footsteps sound in the hallway, and John swiftly shuts the window and steps away, arranging himself casually by the buffet table as the door unlocks, then swings open. It's two of the priests, one pointing John's P90 at John's chest, the other with his arms full of documents, and a cheery, friendly smile that just makes Rodney nervous. "Welcome, gifts of the ancestors," he says. "I hope you have enjoyed your feast. You may need the energy before the night is through." "Feast, yeah," says John, eyes narrow. "Energy for what now?" "To spread your gift, of course. Your seed is precious and will create many heirs of the ancestors to continue our great work." He bows slightly and backs up. "So, you must eat and drink. This is a blessing to both our peoples, Colonel Shepherd, Dr. McKay. And one you shall enjoy, I think." And with that, he turns and leaves, his companion following. "See," says John, reaching for the window again. "Told you. Breeding." He shudders a little. "Let's get the hell out of here." It's not a short drop, Rodney thinks, looking out the window. It's 10 feet straight down, although John claims that they can dangle from the windowsill and drop from there. Honestly, Rodney's not sure he has the coordination to pull that off. "Look, it's easy," says John, glancing out at the bushes below and the deserted backyard. He hops up on the sill and grabs the inside edge of the window frame, shimmying his body out the window. He slips gracefully into the hang directly off the sill and drops down into the bush below. Rodney leans out, grits his teeth, and... That's the sound of the door latch being lifted, and Rodney panics, spins around, and John hisses, "Rodney!" And Rodney has no choice but to jump out the window to his death. Surprisingly, he lands solidly on a relatively soft surface that grunts when he sits up. "Sorry, sorry," he says, rolling off of John. His bare wrist brushes along John's cheekbone, just barely, and this time the swell of anxiousness and relief is nearly manageable. John sits up just as footsteps thunder into the room and shouts ring out. Come on, he says, grabbing Rodney's shirt collar and tugging him upright. They pretty much know where we went. And that's how they end up here, trapped together in a very small cave on an alien planet, trying to keep as far apart as they can when there's barely room for one person, let alone two fidgety, full-grown men. And it's not like they've never been trapped together in a small, rapidly cooling space before. They've had to engage in the time-honored SJC tradition of huddling for warmth plenty of times in the past few years. But usually, the rest of the team is there. And usually, they're not fighting off the effects of some wacky emotion-transferring ancient device. But it's cold and getting colder, and Rodney's starting to shiver harder now. And if he's cold, he can't imagine how Colonel No Body Fat over there must be feeling. He's pretty sure he can hear John's teeth chattering, and he lets out a long sigh. It's too dark to continue towards the gate, and it's not like there's anywhere else to go, and the priest, soldier, whatevers haven't found them yet, so they might as well get comfortable, or as comfortable as they can, with this bizarre sharing thing going on. Hey, he hisses, Shepherd! What? Yeah, definitely shivering like crazy over there, but John's tone is still full of that forbidding warrior man tone he gets when he's trying to be stoic. Idiot, thinks Rodney fondly, and scoots the few inches to John's side, carefully putting an arm around the solidly clothed section of John at the shoulders and tugging him against him. You're freezing, he says. I need you at least semi-functional if we're going to make it out of here tomorrow. John's body stiffens the moment Rodney touches him, but the shivers start to subside after a few moments. Carefully, Rodney wedges his other arm between them and under John's neck, dodging the truly tantalizing skin just under his ear and the pale nape of his neck. Not something he's ever noticed on a guy before, but John's kind of just special like that. Rodney takes a deep breath and tries to focus on what they're going to do once the hordes of priests searching for them clear out, but it's not easy when all he can smell is John's sweat, which, ew, why is that even appealing, but somehow it is, and John's warmth is seeping through 5 layers of clothing to settle deliciously against Rodney's belly and thighs. The adrenaline is finally leaving his body now, and he lets his body drift into the familiar sensation of John close at hand. John's not shivering at all anymore, and his shoulders are starting to relax, just a little, so they're not stuck up by his ears anymore. He even leans back, pressing himself into Rodney more closely, although Rodney is pretty sure it's an unconscious movement. John's not the type to let himself enjoy anything even remotely like cuddling. Well, huddling. For warmth. Rodney has no shame there, though. He's comfortable in his masculinity. His insecurities tend to be more concerned with his competence and courage and less with his gender and sexuality. He's got no problem being snuggled by Taylor or Ronan or even Lorne or Cadman if the situation requires it. Of course, John is a special case, in lots of ways. He fights the bizarre, nearly overwhelming urge to rub the patch of John's warm, hard, cotton-covered stomach where his hand is resting, but just barely. It's not like Rodney spent years lusting over his straight best friend. Or, well, okay, yes, that's pretty much what's been going on. He tries not to think about it most of the time, because, honestly, what good could come of that? But sometimes, in a warming cave on an alien planet, a guy can't help but think about, well, things. John shifts a little, just a little bit to get more comfortable, and it nudges Rodney's shirt up, catching on the fabric of John's. And before Rodney can push what he'd been thinking about far, far down into his repressed subconscious, John makes a choked sound and freezes, not even breathing. And that's when Rodney realizes that the feeling he's been having, that contented, post-adrenaline, possibly in love with John Shepherd feeling, thing is, they're not just coming from him. John, he says, hand clenching a little in John's t-shirt, I can't, John says, you, and he falls silent. There's a long moment where that awful stiffness of John's shoulders is back, but then he lets out a long breath, shuddering a little. Rodney can almost hear John having some sort of long, involved talk with himself, maybe psyching himself up for something, or maybe talking himself down. Rodney knows better than to press at this point. A few years ago, he'd be pushing, be asking John what's up, if he's okay, but he knows John now, knows him like he knows himself, and so he waits, lets John process in the way he needs to. John is his best friend, and a great guy, and absolutely gorgeous, and he's incredible with guns and killing and stuff, but the whole sharing feelings thing, not so much with that. Finally, John takes another deep breath. He reaches down deliberately, hand hovering just above Rodney's, and stops. Rodney holds his breath. And then, minutely, John relaxes a little so their skin meets again. Suddenly, it's like the floodgates have opened, and he's filled with John's confusion and guilt, longing and regret, understanding and belonging and rightness. He curls closer, reflecting it all back, letting it wash through both of them until they're both shuddering with the weight of what they're sharing. Then John pulls back, rolls over, and presses closer, chest to chest with Rodney. "Yeah," he says, voice hoarse. "Me too, Rodney." And he kisses him, lips soft and plush, and oh so sweet, and Rodney wishes so very much that they were in a bed, somewhere safe, because right now all he wants to do is bury himself in that fucking kiss. But he's worn out from running, full of worry for Taylor and Ronan, and emotionally exhausted, and his eyes keep drifting shut of their own accord. So instead, he lets John pull away with a tangible wash of regret, wraps his arms tighter around him, and tucks his head into the crook of John's neck. And eventually, his breathing evens out and he sleeps, while John lays awake, vigilant, arms tight around Rodney's body. There's no time to talk about it in the morning, though, because he wakes up to John's hand shaking his shoulder and his voice hissing, "Rodney, we gotta move!" So they're running again a minute later, stumbling through the trees, dodging bushes and streams and other obstacles. The priests are just 100 feet behind them when they clear the tree line, but they're catching up, fresher than John and Rodney, as well as much more familiar with the area. Rodney is just beginning to panic a little when light bursts forth ahead from the Stargate, and a familiar ship blasts through. "John? Rodney?" crackles through the radio, and Rodney nearly laughs with relief at Taylor's voice. The puddle jumper speeds towards them, then spins, dropping down and lowering the hatch just enough for them to jump on, then lifting back up before it has finished shutting. Rodney and John both grin at the sight of Taylor, Ronan, Major Lorne, and a team of Marines. "Looks like you didn't need that rescue after all," says Lorne with a wide grin. "We appreciate the lift," John says, catching his breath as the gate closes, then redials. "Now get us out of here." Elizabeth's eyes widen at the explanation of the device and what it does, gaze flicking from John to Rodney and back. "And it's only with each other?" she asks, curious. Rodney nods. "I'm not sure what use it originally had, interrogative technique, sex toy, training tool, whatever, but I'd like to turn it off as soon as possible." "John?" He leans back in his chair. "It's, not exactly the most convenient thing, feeling Rodney's feelings, so, yeah." Elizabeth nods decisively. "I'll put together a negotiating party of people without the gene. Meanwhile, you two have had quite a day. Maybe you should get some rest." "If you'll excuse me, everyone, I'm covered in who knows how many allergens. I'm going to take a shower and a nap, and then maybe have lunch." Rodney stands, rolling stiff shoulders. "Sounds like a plan." John stands, too. "Elizabeth, let me know what you get from these guys." She nods. "I will." Rodney pushes past John on the way out, forearm brushing against John's in passing, and there's a burst of anticipation, nervousness, and something soft and sweet. It's nothing Rodney can really describe, but it warms him through and through. As John falls in step beside him, he can't help but think how much easier this is than actually talking about things. Still, there's something almost dishonest about it. While he's certainly grateful to get a glimpse at the Major Shepherd that's under all that hair and sass, he'd like to be able to maybe touch John and not share every single emotion he's feeling. It just sort of gets embarrassing for both of them, really, if he thinks about it too hard. But for now, it's easiest to walk silently through the corridors, knuckles brushing occasionally, reassuringly, and to both step through Rodney's door. It's easy to fall together, hands sliding beneath shirts, belts sliding open, clothes falling to the floor. They're in nearly constant contact now, and when their chests press together, all Rodney can feel is the same thrum of rightness from before, in the cave. He's not sure which of them it's coming from, or if it's just both of them amplifying each other, but all he can think is that he's right where he wants to be. "Colonel?" Rodney wakes with a start and reaches for the radio on the nightstand, fumbling it into his ear. "Dr. McKay?" He grabs the second one, tosses it onto John's chest, John's bare chest, John's amazing chest, John's chest that he came all over last night. And he cuts off this line of thought before it gets too far, because he's in serious danger of just falling into a loop like that forever, and clears his throat. "McKay, what's going on?" "Rodney, we have the device. It seems to be some sort of long-range communicator. It is perhaps broken, but I believe I will be able to reverse the effects, says Radek. A hand brushes over Rodney's belly, and he nearly lets out a yelp or a moan or some other sound he'd really not want broadcast over the main radio channels when the wave of sleepy attraction sweeps into him. He reaches down, smacks at John's hand, and rolls on his side, aware from Lieutenant Colonel Teasalot. That's great. I'll just, find Colonel Shepard then. The hand is now sliding over his boxer-clad ass, satisfaction telegraphing through it into Rodney. He swallows, because there are fingers working their way into his waistband and curling around his bare hip. We'll be there in, an hour or two. Rodney? Radek's voice is perplexed. You said this was urgent. Yes, well, Rodney hopes the strangled tone of his voice is muffled in static or something, because there's a warm, wet mouth leaving lush kisses and a trail of mischievous glee across his shoulder blades. I think I might, have to finish something first. Give me an hour, Radek. He jumps as John's hand curls around his cock. Maybe two! He yanks the radio out of his ear and rolls back onto his back to glare at Shepard, who's... Shepard... who's talking into his radio completely calmly, as if he's not rock hard and rubbing himself against Rodney's hip, as if he's not jerking Rodney off while chatting with their boss. Finally, John puts the radio aside and props himself up on an elbow, hands still making loose strokes up and down Rodney's cock. So, good news. Elizabeth got the device. Sounds like we can get cured and stop avoiding each other, he says, conversationally. And Rodney shoves at him until he falls backwards, laughing. Rodney straddling his hips and tugging at his boxers. Later, says Rodney, bending down until he's pressed against John's perfect, hairy, lean chest. Much, much later. The end. The written work can be found at archiveofourown.org/works/308-0516.